It's 7:41 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Today, we'll listen to an investigative report by Marketplace producer Caitlin Ish. We'll learn what's recently revealed documents can tell us about the aggressive marketing campaign 20 years ago for a pain pill called OxyContin.
Some of the information has, for the last 13 years, been sitting in an envelope marked sealed in a West Virginia county courthouse.
That story's coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. This week on Inside Appalachia, we go back 20 years to when an addictive opioid, OxyContin, was first put on the market. The episode features a special investigative report by The Uncertain Hour, a podcast from Marketplace. The story explores the marketing strategy of one particular pharmaceutical company, Purdue Pharma. In this segment, you'll hear Chrissy Clark, senior correspondent for Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty team and the host for The Uncertain Hour.
So when you get a prescription drug at the pharmacy, it comes in a box or a bottle. And maybe you've noticed that you also get this little package insert that comes with it. Often it's this very long, folded up piece of paper in very small print, with a lot of medical and scientific jargon in it, information about clinical studies, dosing, side effects. Maybe you've tried to read one of these in a prescription you've gotten. Maybe you've given up. They're pretty dense. In the pharmaceutical world, this package insert is referred to as the label, not to be confused with that little sticker on the bottle that you or I might call the label, but this jargony package insert. And I'm holding in my hands one of these package inserts, one of these labels. It's one you can't find at a pharmacy anymore. The label I'm looking at right now is the original label from 1995 for OxyContin, you know, the painkiller. It's produced by Purdue Pharma. OxyContin was approved by government regulators at the Food and Drug Administration in 1995. And part of that approval process involved approving the words on this label. The label's really long, 21 pages, but on page 15, under the drug abuse and dependence section, there's this one sentence.
Delayed absorption, as provided by OxyContin tablets, is believed to reduce the abuse liability of a drug.
It's a mouthful, so I'll read it to you again. Delayed absorption, as provided by OxyContin tablets, is believed to reduce the abuse liability of a drug. Remember that sentence. It arguably helped open the floodgates to the opioid epidemic. In plain English, here's what that sentence is saying. That first part about delayed absorption, that just means your body doesn't absorb OxyContin all at once. In fact, that's what the contin in OxyContin refers to, continuous. There's a time-release mechanism in the pills that doles out the active ingredient, oxycodone, continuously over many hours. So that's the first part of the sentence. And then the sentence goes on to say that because of this delayed absorption, it is believed by whom, the sentence doesn't say, but it is believed that people will be less likely to abuse OxyContin, to take it to get high rather than treat pain. The problem is that sentence turned out to be highly misleading. OxyContin turned out to be highly abusable. And the aftershocks of that sentence, we're still feeling them today. Our question was, how did government regulators let that sentence slip into the label? Who wrote it and why? We've all heard the heartbreaking stories of abuse and addiction.
The number of deaths from opioid abuse continues to climb.
This epidemic is a national health emergency.
The doctor's death is a grim reminder of a nation addicted to opioids.
It's just devastating for these babies.
America's worst drug crisis ever.
We have a 9/11 scale loss every 3 weeks.
More than 300,000 people have died from opioid overdoses since 1999. Another 2 million are addicted, In 2015 alone, the economic cost of the opioid crisis was more than $500 billion, according to the White House Council of Economic Advisors. So these are things we've heard. But here's something you may not have heard. Some of the opioid epidemic's roots lie in paperwork. Boring paperwork, like this 21-page label for OxyContin. We spent 8 months digging through the regulatory paperwork that brought OxyContin to market. We filed countless requests with federal agencies to get access to hard-to-find documents. We reviewed hundreds of pages of court records and obtained one court order. We dug up stuff that has never been made public, as far as we can tell. Some of the information has, for the last 13 years, been sitting in an envelope marked sealed in a West Virginia county courthouse. And together, all these documents help explain how we got to this point of national crisis. There were a lot of factors at play, but you could argue a lot of it traces back to the power of a single sentence and the power of a pharmaceutical company to shape regulations.
That's Chrissy Clark, host of The Uncertain Hour. It's a podcast from Marketplace and APM. You can hear more of this report. It goes into great detail about that place in McDowell County, West Virginia, where she found all this information about the start of the OxyContin crisis here in West Virginia. On Inside Appalachia, that's our show that airs Sunday morning at 7 and Sunday evenings at 6 here on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. It's also an awesome podcast. I'm Scott Finn here with Michelle Lewis.
The time is 7:48, and we'll be back with more West Virginia Morning just ahead. We know you're getting your morning routine started with us, and we're working on a goal of $800 before 8 o'clock. We can get there with your help. It's quality reporting that's an essential part of what we do every day, and it's why you depend on us. We're asking you, let us depend on you now. Go ahead and make your call of support as a sustainer. For $11 a month, we can send along a box of Hall's chocolates in time for Valentine's Day, and you'll be doing your part to protect this service. 1-800-723-4687. Incredible times, Scott. Incredible questions on how to move ahead. And reporting like this is giving us some answers.
Yeah, it's really important. Michelle, I got an email from a gentleman. His name is Minter Ralston, Mint. And he says he's a former Marine and former Mountaineer who now lives in Charlotte and listened to Inside Appalachia and the recent episode they did on the opioid crisis. And he had a challenge. He's like, we know what the problems are, so what about some of the solutions? And I'm here to tell you that, Mint, that we here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting are committed this year, 2018, to talk more about the solutions to the opioid crisis. We've been doing this reporting about the crisis itself for 20 years, and we have committed as a newsroom and as a team here to talk about how we can help actually move the needle and solve this crisis. And when you support West Virginia Public Broadcasting, you support that at 800-RADIO-87.
You're helping to protect the service. You're helping to protect the news coverage that helps people get the broader perspective of what's going on in the world and how our world is being shaped. We're asking you because you believe in it, because you count on it, to make a pledge of support at any level right now. We suggest different levels. We suggest thank you gifts, but the point is, we're asking you to protect it now with your pledge of support at 800-723-4687. Let's go back to more West Virginia Morning.
During yesterday's episode of The Legislature Today, host Andrea Lanham sat down with Barry Cook, the director of the West Virginia Division of Forestry, to talk about a controversial bill that would open many state parks to logging. Here's a portion of that interview taped live from the Capitol.
I know you've said that this is a conservation effort, not a commercial logging program, and we've just heard from the Commissioner of Agriculture, and he called Senate Bill 270 poorly thought out with little foresight. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, Andrea, the forests are, in our parks are very mature forests, and under good management, as the trees mature, then before they reach an age at which they die, it's really good to harvest those. Trees are much like we are. You know, we're born and we're young and we grow very viable. We reach a maturity age. And at some point, our bodies begin to deteriorate, and we actually die then. And, you know, trees follow this same, all plants really follow this same pattern. And the natural succession is when they're mature before they die, you know, you remove them and that leaves room for the younger trees to come back and grow back into another forest for the next generation.
But why in state parks?
Well, West Virginia is unique. Our parks are huge. We have 38 state parks that take up about 81,000 acres. About nine of those parks make up over half of that acreage. So I heard Senator speaking about logging in some of these smaller parks. That is not the intent of the bill. The logging would take place in these much larger parks in the backcountry, away from the area that's used as recreational areas. Once the logging is completed, the road system and stuff that's put in place in order to remove the timber will be converted to new trails. This will actually expand the footprint of the park to where people can go deeper into the park and use more of the park for recreation.
What about tourism? There's a concern that we've heard from West Virginia citizens, and it's also been said that this is incongruent with our efforts to promote tourism in the state.
Done improperly, I would totally agree. But yeah, I have a good friend who is the state forester in the state of Ohio. Ohio practices forestry on their state forests, as we do in West Virginia, but they also practice forestry on their state parks. After they harvest an area in both their parks and their forests, they put up monuments or placards, which explains the type of harvesting that was actually done in that area. And they use it as an educational tool for the public. And they had their tourism has actually grown in their state parks. The usage of their parks has grown because of this, and used it as an education tool. People are very interested in what was done in this area and why it was done.
If you're talking four trees per acre, why do it at all?
Well, it's four trees per acre average over the entire area that you designate to possibly be areas that can log. So, say if you've got a park that's 10,000 acres and there's only 2,000 acres being used for the public, that would be 8,000 acres that you could have harvesting. Now, you would not harvest all that 8,000 acres at one time. It would be blocks in there. But the way the bill's written, you just average four trees per acre over that entire harvesting area. So it actually gives you the opportunity. You have acres that will have little or no trees on it, and you have acres that have more than four, so you're really trying to average the four. But under no circumstances can you ever remove more than one half of the volume from any one acre, so that totally precludes ever being able to clear cut.
So we heard Delegate Cooper argue that state parks don't generate enough money for repairs. How bad are these needed repairs, and how much revenue is anticipated if this bill passes?
Well, all I can speak about is what I've been told from Director McDaniels, Director of DNR. And he said, as you heard, most of these parks, lodges and cabins and stuff were built in the 50s and 60s. So they're... And there's not been a lot of money spent on them over the years, so they are, some of them, in pretty bad repair, I understand. Again, I do not have the specifics of that because it's really not my area.
But is there no better revenue stream to establish for our state parks?
Well, you know, this is not the only revenue stream they plan on using. There's other revenue streams that will be generated. I really don't know exactly what all those are, but this is only part of the revenue stream that would be used.
That was Andrea Lanham speaking with Barry Cook, the director of the West Virginia Division of Forestry, on our television program, The Legislature Today, weeknights at 6 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. To hear the rest of this interview, visit our website, wvpublic.org. An ear for cinematic folk music, critically acclaimed singer Iron and Wine performs We Too Are a Moon during this week's Mountain Stage Song of the Week.
This song is a love letter to toss into the fire. Wind comes through the window, faces carve into the heart. Find a soul and feel it. Hearts have hidden rooms. Sing with me to wrong gods. Music isn't safe. This love is a photograph of snow kept in a cloud. We don't look for failure, but it's teaching us the world. And it's open kisses, mercy among stones. Horses in the doorway, running out of rain. And we all die of thirst. We put family first. The world can withhold so much beauty.